Well, hello, and thank you for having me here. It's a great honor to be here in San Francisco, and I hope you will forgive me my exotic Balkan accent. And you're probably asking yourself, what is this guy from the Balkans? Why is he speaking about Boblis and Zapatistas? Well, the reason is that I actually find both Boblis and Zapatistas to be an exemplary, paradigmatic, actually case, both of them, in ways of how we can organize in the future, meaning in the here and now. In that sense, I think that Boblis and Zapatistas were where we have been, where we want to go, where we should go. And let me say what I clarify what I mean by this in, I think, 20 minutes or 10 minutes, so we can have some conversation too. Namely, as far as I understand, Zapatistas and the man who took the name Marcos went to the jungle, Selva La Condona, leaving their relatively comfortable positions at the UNAM, Mexican University. They somehow found the imagination to actually leave the university and go to the jungle, where they met Mayans who lived a decentralized, communal, indigenous way of life, basically anarchistic way of life for centuries. Then the interesting thing happened, and this is the first element of Zapatismo. Marxists actually talked and listened to the Mayans, and they ended up learning more from Mayans than Mayans did learn from Marxists. Second thing, they discovered something that we call here direct democracy or tradition of communal democracy, and Mayans have a term for this, mandar obedeciendo. The heart of the whole democratic process is village assemblea, or the assembly. They encountered liberation theology, extremely interesting mix of liberation theology presented by the delegate of the word, Bishop Ruiz. And finally, what Zapatistas also discovered there was the tradition of Emiliano Zapata and struggle for land and for freedom, which is still very much alive in Mexico, as you know, especially in Chiapas. So it was a synthesis, and it was a synthesis that this synthesis that emerged out of this experience of this group of Marxists accompanying the Mayan Indians could not have been invented in a library. This is a theory. This is a synthesis that came out of a discussion, many discussions that had to be discussed and rediscussed, practiced and practiced again. And again, these are not kinds of synthesis that can emerge from universities. This emerged from a group of people, students, intellectuals, teachers, who left the university in order to go to a place who had humility and who had patience and persistence to go and meet people who are very much different than they are and to enjoy an experience and discover an experience that's very much different than their own. The interesting thing is that I think of Zapatistas, and this is the book that is being sold at the PM table that I did with Staunton Lind, of the Zapatistas as a synthesis of what is best in the anarchist and Marxist traditions. This is not the first attempt of the sort in North America. The very interesting way of creating this kind of synthesis were unfortunately very much forgotten by the anarchists, Chicago anarchists, and something that we refer to as a Haymarket synthesis. Back in the day, in 19th century, Chicago idea represented the belief that militant trade unions should be the germs of a new social order. James Green wrote a beautiful book about them, about the Chicago anarchists, and he said that they were at the same time Marxists and anarchists. They invented a peculiar brand of socialism that they called anarchism. This tradition, this Haymarket synthesis, was very much kept alive by the Wobblies. I myself am a Wobbly, and I invite all of you to discover this beautiful tradition, again, very much forgotten, sadly, by many on the American radical left. And Wobblies were founded in 1905 as a very heterogeneous assemblage of different kind of radicals, different kind of unions, of Western Federation of Miners, of migrant agricultural workers who were following the harvest, who were going from south to west and from west to east and from east to west, from south to north, of people who were textile workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts, people who in 1912 won the famous strike for bread and roses, people who cut timber together, blacks and whites, in piney forests in the South. People who were working together, again, blacks and whites, on the docks of Philadelphia. That is the first interracial union in the history of the United States. Wobblies were actually the only movement of the time who was completely open to participation of immigrants, African Americans, and women. Joe Hill, as many of you, you of course know who Joe Hill was, but Joe Hill was not only born in Sweden, he also fought in Mexico. And he was, if you read Franklin Rosamond's excellent book, he was also a Chinese chef. He had a very special interest in Chinese cooking. This kind of internationalism, feeling of oneness with all people in the world who are struggling for freedom, is something quite remarkable. Wobblies barely survived the repression of the 1920s. And it is all the more miraculous, this flamboyant, innovative, amazing, solid culture of solidarity that this band of rebels left for us. And we should learn how to respect this culture and how to learn from it. In 1930s, and after 1930s, the task of criticizing the national unionism, CIO unionism, was left to isolated workers' intellectuals like Stenweer, Martin Glaberman, and Stoughton Lind. But IWW has been reinvented in recent years by a new generation of young radicals, and this is probably a part of a larger phenomenon of rediscovering the left libertarian, libertarian socialist, or anarchist thought. The interesting thing about Wobblies, another component of Wobblism, was direct action. That was a central principle of what Wobblies did. So, for example, the workers in Schenectady, New York, they discovered a way of not leaving the factory, but they actually sat down next to the machines. That was the invention of the famous sit-in, refusing to leave the factory. Flint, Michigan will repeat this in 1937. Famous Wobbly fights for free speech. I mean, they're extremely well known, and I'm sure that many of you are familiar with them. But Wobblies would fill up the city squares of Western towns. They were prohibiting free speech. They were incarcerated, but the cost of incarceration was so high that the city fathers had to let them go and in disgust and have to let them mount their soapbox and preach the ideas of abolishing of wage slavery. Wobblies believed in one big union, in the idea that we need to create a new world in the shell of the old. And the way to do this is to go beyond the American separation of labor, as they used to call it. Another thing that Wobblies fiercely contested was any kind of hierarchy, hierarchical leadership. One of my favorite anecdotes is the anecdote when Goodship Verona went to Everett, Washington, to join the free speech fight. And it was a ship full of Wobblies. Wobblies left the ship, and they encountered Sheriff McRae with his men. And Sheriff McRae asked, "Who is your leader?" And it was an unmistakable, immediate answer from every IWW person over there saying, "We are all leaders." After that, Sheriff McRae, this is something that we don't talk much about, Sheriff McRae actually opened fire, killing five fellow workers. But this is the thing that Wobblies were. This is amazing, inspiring tradition that I am myself very much proud to be a part of. And I think that we can actually learn a lot from in thinking how we can, both from Wobblies and Zapatistas, understand, I think there is a microphone issue. How can we understand this reality? And I shall try to generalize from Zapatista Wobbly reality as I have tried to describe it. And I shall try to propose the following principles of how we can think about organizing a new movement today. Because today, in the context of crisis of capitalism, I think that we have a huge responsibility to be serious about the way that we organize. First, in building a new movement, we should rely on our own self-activity, expressed through organizations at the base that we ourselves create and control. Revolution is not taking state power. It should not be about taking the power of the state. It should be about, it's a process of unending creation of horizontally linked self-governed entities. The first principle, therefore, is self-activity. Second principle is we need to build more than organization. We need to build more than just a movement. We need to build a genuine community of struggle. And this is the most difficult one. The third one is not to engage in what Alfred Whitehead called the misplaced concreteness of mistaking words for things. We are swamped, we are suffocated by theory today. We need some good old direct action in addition to analysis. We need a new relationship to theory as well as strategy and program. As for self-activity, I think that I don't need to tell you more about this. But, and I have to do this with desperate brevity because of the time, I think that we need to engage a little bit more in the second principle, which is the principle of solidarity. Capitalism developed in feudalism or within feudalism as a practice of contract. Anarchism should develop within capitalism as a practice of solidarity. How do we practice this solidarity? Solidarity can be practiced in struggle. There is a solidarity in struggle. There is also a solidarity, and this is, I think, indispensable. There is a solidarity inside of the movement. And we have been neglecting it for far too long. If we organize our meetings as snake pits, as places where we have shouting matches, as the places where we insult each other, which unfortunately we do way too often, if we don't behave like compañeras, like fellow workers, like brothers and sisters, how can we accept the people who are not part of our movement to join us? Why should they? Why should they entrust us with this task of building a new society? They won't and they shouldn't. So we have to change something. We have to change the way they are thinking about solidarity. Look at anarchism today. As somebody who became an anarchist at the age of 12, I think that I'm qualified to say that anarchism in the United States is a mess. We are not a movement. We are a scene. We need to transform ourselves into a serious political movement. Anarchists, more than anybody else, should be faithful to the injunction that a genuine revolutionary needs to learn how to swim in the sea of people. If he doesn't, if she doesn't, then she is guilty of being called what in German they call socialist of the chair. We should not do this. It's a conspiracy of people working at universities to speak about, present their ideas to other people working at the university and pretend that they're very important. I reject it. I think that we should all reject this. I think that we should follow Marcos to the different Lacondomas, different Chiapases that exist in our own countries here in the United States and try to learn something new. Instead of, and I'm sure that we are all going to agree here, that there is a problem, we are all going to reject Marxist-Leninist vanguardism. With almost piously we are going to reject it. But we are not going to think about our own revolutionary practice, which is similarly vanguardist. When we think about, there is a huge problem about organizing. Organizer always comes with this idea that he or she somehow knows better what is or what should happen with people that he or she is trying to organize. I think this is a huge problem. And the thing that Stotelnit and myself are proposing instead is something that we call the accompaniment. Process of accompaniment. Very much like the Zapatistas. I don't organize you. You don't organize me. I accompany you and you accompany me. The idea of accompagnado, which actually means like compañero breaking bread together, is a beautiful interpretation, means what is implicit is that there is no complete map. Seeker, there is no road. You make the road by walking. What a revolutionary should do is to go where struggling people are, make himself, herself useful, join this struggle. We need to rediscover populism, the way that Russian populists understood it once back in the day, the way that Wobblies understood it back in the day, the way that Chicago anarchists understood it back in the day. We need to start to swim and learn how to swim in the sea of people. And accompaniment, I think in that sense, is a beautiful guide to practice. And it's a beautiful process that transcends the problems presented by revolutionary vanguardism of the anarchists and revolutionary vanguardists, of course, of the old traditional Bolshevik left. So we live today in a situation that is pretty horrible. If you think about it, there are two serious occasions. On one level, the problem, now I'm coming back to the third principle of theory. We are living in a time that is, people are jobless. We are not in recession, we are in depression, and this is going to get worse, meaning that a lot of people are going to be without jobs. We need to find meaningful ways of connecting with these people. On the second level, there is a structural, according to Marxist theorists that I actually respect, like Emmanuel Wallerstein, there is a structural crisis of capitalism. Capitalism is falling apart. This endless accumulation of profit is not serving the interests of capitalist class well. They are trying to find a new system. And that system can turn to be a very ugly system, maybe even uglier, if we can imagine that, than capitalism itself. We need to do the same. We need to create strategy. We need to create program. We need a vision. We need to get very serious about these things, because we are going to find ourselves in a very bad place if we don't do this, because they are doing this as we speak. And finally, let me conclude with this, and maybe if we have time we can talk a little bit more and about questions that you might have. I said that I am from the Balkans, so let me finish with the Balkans. You know about the Greek riots, and I'm sure you know something about Greek mythology. We live in chaotic times. But in Greek mythology, chaos is not disorder. Chaos means a vacant space that is awaiting occupation. And it is in chaos that it was silver egg was laid, which hatched Eros. And there's another one, beautiful Greek word, ancient Greek word, called Kairos, which means the right moment. We live in times of Kairos. If there ever was a moment for us to react, for us to learn from Wobblies, for us to learn from the Zapatistas, it is today. We have to fight capitalism. We have to fight state. We have to fight the hierarchies everywhere, with all the passion and all the intelligence that we have and possess. Thank you. Okay, so I hope you have some questions. Yes.
You touched on Greece. Could you say anything further about what may be taking place in the background?
Okay, what is happening in Greece? There was a first experience of riots. It's completely misplaced. The name that people use is the first credit crunch riot. It's not true. That never happened. What happened in Greece was assertion of dignity, was assertion, Greece has a very complicated history, but this is assertion of dignity, and many Greek comrades assure me that the most important slogan for them was, we are here, because they were made invisible. We are here. What is happening now is that they are not in the headlines anymore, because they are not rioting. What Greeks are doing right now, they are occupying. And they're creating structures and forms of direct democracy. It's very much in Greek tradition, in keeping with Greek tradition. There is a people's insurgent opera, national theater, that has been occupied by the workers who are running the theater. Ballet dancers, actors, they're running the theater, they're self-managing the theater. So there is a whole wave after the wave of riots, there is a wave of occupation and experiments in self-management and direct democracy. And it's even more inspiring than the riots. I will be going there in May. There is a huge political festival of people from all over Europe coming there and showing their solidarity with Greek comrades. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic.
Could you talk more about the internationalism of guilt?
Internationalism of the guilt is something that Stoughton, Lind, and myself mentioned in the book Wobblies and Zapatistas. For me, it was, again, coming from the Balkans, it was really interesting to discover that so many people in the United States, radicals, are suffering from all kinds of guilt. I didn't know how to approach this, really. For me, it was a huge problem. I went to There is a magazine that's very popular. I'm not going to tell you the name of the magazine, leftist magazine, and I left to see the editor. And I told him, so what about the white working class? And he told me, you mean the rednecks? Why would you organize rednecks? He's a middle-class bourgeois kid who feels very guilty because he's white. You know, which is good, probably, but the way of thinking about these things should not be completely to forget the issue of class. What really strikes me here in the United States is that people completely left the class out of the equation. We are talking about everything else, and we should be talking about everything else, but we should also be talking about class. But I think that what you are asking me goes a little bit deeper. There is a culture of guilt, which I guess is related to the Protestant heritage here in the United States or to something else. I'm not really sure. But people keep feeling guilty. I am so guilty, I cannot do... No. I went to the anarchist space in Philadelphia. And I said, what are you doing with people of color? Because they were all white in this anarchist space. But I said, you know, we are colonizers. I said, but why are you not talking to them? Well, you know, we are the colonizers. So guilt is not a very productive emotion. And something weird happened in the United States, I think. You have few waves of organizing. The Marxist-Leninist vanguardist way was way of colonization. I mean, some of you remember this. Colonizing factories. That was the language that people used. They were colonizing the factories. This kind of dissatisfaction with this mode of organizing led to different ways of rethinking revolutionary practice. One of them was the so-called friendly intellectual option, which means you stay at the university, you work in the library, write books like Multitude or Changeable Without Taking Power, and you actually don't know what is really going on anywhere. The other thing was the social worker approach, which is, you know, I'm a revolutionary, but what I really do, I take care of the kids. I am outside of the community. I'm not part of the community of struggle. I'm just helping them. Which is, you know, the role that in liberal theory state has. You know, you are a social, and the United States doesn't have a good social system, so I understand that there is a need for social workers. But I think that we as revolutionaries need to have a different perspective, different relationship with communities in struggle, which is the one of accompaniment that I tried to explain. So what I meant by internationalism of guilt is exactly that people are trying to find always some kind of an exotic subject here in the United States that they should fetishize out of existence. Nepalese Maoists, even to some extent Zapatistas. But they don't look into the history, this wonderful, beautiful history like the Wobblies. I mean, God, is there a more beautiful movement? And they're looking into this functional equivalence in Nepal or wherever else without actually thinking about normal, ordinary people at home. Organizing with your neighbors. They're not doing this. And this, I think, is a very big problem. And I think it's related to this feeling of being guilty and belonging to a white middle class, being a white middle class dropout. And I don't think it's a horrendous situation. You know, anarchism being a scene which is populated not by working class people, by people who are mostly middle class, should not be another reason for feeling guilty. If you think about Russia in 1905, the first Soviet was built in the University of St. Petersburg in 1905. If you think about the Hungary in 57, and I urge you to read this beautiful book by Andy, whatever his last name is, I can't remember now. But in 57, it started with Petefi Circle, with intellectuals, with dropouts, with what in Eastern Europe we called left intelligentsia. Workers then joined in magnificently. But the first came the students, dropouts, middle-class elements. And I don't know to what extent Gramsci is right about the hegemony of bourgeois ideas, but sometimes the dropouts, the leftists, the intellectuals, students, professors, they can break through it. They can create a space for workers to experiment, to think, to struggle. And the problem that I see in the United States is that people are not doing it. We are not doing it. We need to approach and create these kinds of spaces. Another question? Dave, Dave.
Oh, hey, Andre, once again, we're on the same page. That's what I say, let's get on the same page. Get all the bonds and push them to hell. Because hell is a network, as you said, that's going all the way around the planet. I guess anarchy includes a bohemian element that the other leftists deny, reject, and try to put down. And I think we're talking about that bohemian spirit. And saying, take down the walls and the doors. I give them the borders to families, tribes, communities, collectives. I think of that. The borders just a lot on their back.
Okay, that's good. Great.
The crisis is coming together. What the economic crisis, how the economic conflict, what the environmental crisis, the environmental global balance. They're coming together in one big crisis.
Thanks, Dave. Let me give you just one example. I'm working with people who are called Lucasville Five. I'm writing a book about them right now. Lucasville Five is a rebellion that erupted in prison in Ohio, the longest prison rebellion in the history of the United States. 11 days, people, convicts, came together from Muslim gangster disciples, from Muslim Sunni Brotherhood, and from Aryan Brotherhood, which you know what it is, of course, in Ohio, Youngstown, Ohio. The most remarkable rebellion happened there. After the rebellion, people went in and saw graffiti on the wall saying one race, convict race. No whites, no blacks, only blues, the color of the uniform. These people are the most magnificent people, intellectuals, that you can ever hope to encounter. They are now on death row. They're called Lucasville Five. One of them, Keith Lamar, whose name is Bomani Shakur now, is writing his memoirs to be published with PM Press. The foreword, the introduction, is written by his best friend, whose name is Jason Robb, who is the head of the Aryan Brotherhood for the state of Ohio. If they can do it, so can we. I think we have to finish. Thank you so much for coming.